Hello, and welcome to the Slongcast, episode 11 for Monday, July 26, 2010. Got a full studio again this week, so I guess I can say now that our studio audience from last week is actually on the show this week. He was just, you know, monitoring us, seeing what we did, and so, you know, as usual, I'm Kevin Slonka, the host here, and in studio, Ryan Lancey.
Hey.
And new on this show is Ed Zahurik.
Hey, everyone.
All right, so we got a lot of good stories, some crazy things, more security stuff as usual. But the first story that I found that was really interesting is one more step in Google taking over the world. So it appears that most of us around here in Pennsylvania know of Penelec, and Penelec is our electricity company. Well, it appears that Google is going to be that for some people now. Google just bought a large portion of energy, and they got the go-ahead by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to buy and sell electricity back in February. So it appears that for some people, I don't know when they're going to go public with this, but they have the go-ahead now. They are allowed to be an electric company. This is crazy. I mean, is this necessary?
Well, I think it's a little similar to idea of, like, you know, somebody owning the owning some solar panels and selling electricity back to the grid. And you know, I don't think it's so out of the question for these for Google to buy a set of wind turbines or some other kind of energy source and energy production center and whatever unused electricity they have sell back to the grid.
And I don't think it's the first one they bought. I think they have their own hydroelectric dams somewhere. Mm-hmm. It probably makes sense for Google. They use a lot of energy. They've started with a green energy initiative several years ago, 2007, I think. They're doing a lot in the arena of trying to use sustainable energy, renewable energy sources.
There's a lot of options out there, you know, with all these new renewable energy sources, like you said, and so I don't think it's out of the question. I mean, Google uses a lot of electricity. I'm sure the usage is ebb and flow with demand, and I could see them having some excess energy there, excess electricity supply that they'd want to sell back to the grid. So it makes sense. And I guess when you're talking about turbines this size and wind farms this size, there's probably some kind of regulatory rules that you run into that basically they'd have to file the paperwork and all the other sort of thing to be able to own that. So
yeah, and from what I was reading too, it's a little convoluted. They can't actually use the energy that they're producing in this case, but they have to sell it back to folks.
Yeah,
somehow.
Well, they want to be carbon neutral.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the idea. I don't know how you become carbon neutral unless you sequester carbon, though. That's what I didn't really understand about the article. They said that, you know, these companies are using alternative resources, and I guess they're getting carbon credits or will be.
Yeah, they've some of the links from that article posted. You went back to their some of their original initiative and information on that, and they talked about that. You know, they've got a multitude approach. They are buying carbon credits. They are investing directly in sources. They're building their own, or they're investing in other sources. I think it's probably a good idea from the standpoint that they're backing renewable energy. They're putting money out there so that, you know, to further more innovation. I think it's probably a good thing for Google. It's probably a good thing for renewable energy. It's probably not going to be good for people who aren't a fan of windmills or really like migratory waterfowl and bats. But
mm-hmm. Yeah. We're having some technical difficulties here in the studio, folks. So we're trying to cover ourselves. But
yeah, this is my bad. Forgot to get our guest on the internet here. So let's just keep going here. Next story, which kind of surprised me. It's about Google and their web browser, Google Chrome. And the thing with most tools that we use is that whenever you get a new version number, say goes from Firefox 2 to Firefox 3, you get a huge jump in features. I mean, sometimes the whole program looks completely different. And as far as Google Chrome is concerned, they're not doing that anymore. They say that throughout this year, they are going to release Chrome 6, 7, and 8, all major version numbers. And instead of being huge feature releases, they're just going to release little things as they come up with them, you know, one at a time. So what do you guys think about this, you know, totally going against what every company has ever done ever in terms of version numbering for software?
Well, I mean, it's not surprising. Like they say in the article, and I found this, I fact-checked this because I was really surprised at this number. You know, Chrome was in version 1 14 months ago. That's hard to believe. It's already version 5. So it doesn't seem unthinkable that they could reach version 8 by, and what was it, by year's end? So, you know, it's to me, it's just, it's, it seems like it's in the cards. But the one thing the article said was that, you know, that they'll be bringing major features to the users faster. And I don't know that that's necessarily true. If it just like always with Chrome, there's little incremental features that are added.
Yeah, I think coming up in the future releases, an integrated PDF browser, a new video codec, I believe. What's interesting to me too is how much more they're minimalizing the browser. I mean, it's getting to the point where they're removing the go button. They're combining the refresh button and the stop button. They're combining their two menus down into one. Before too long, it's probably going to be like a browser with one button and a browser window, and that's about it.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely a minimalist browser, and that's part of the reason I love Chrome.
Oh, I love it, too. It's the one, you know, on my personal machines, it's the one I use all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, you guys. Mm-hmm. Not my favorite browser, but...
It doesn't crash on Facebook like Firefox.
That is true. Firefox is always breaking Facebook for me.
But I bet it's actually the other way around.
Facebook is always breaking Firefox?
Yeah, it probably
I'm sure
is.
That's it.
Yeah. Just, you know, knowing Zuckerberg.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure I've stated my own personal feelings on Chrome here before. I don't know. I don't like the way it looks. I think that's really what gets me, is that I just don't like the way it looks. I don't like, you know, the minimalist number of items in the toolbar. I mean, there really isn't even a toolbar anymore. I don't like the lack of title bar that you can't grab onto. There's like 2 pixels at the top that you have to work with if you want to grab and move the window. And I guess if you've seen the screenshots of Firefox 4, they're moving to the same type of thing. Like they have, you know, one big button. The tabs have now been moved from below the address bar to above the address bar. Everybody seems to be going to the way that Chrome looks now.
Yeah, there's actually... Did you happen to see the video that they talked about, the design of the new new Firefox layout and why they moved the tabs up?
I didn't see a video about that. I saw a video about the new what's the name of it? Tab Clicky? Or whatever the new tabbing scheme they have is.
Well, right. But one of the big design changes in the UI they made is that they bumped the tabs up above the address bar, just like they do in Chrome. So they basically moved away from the way IE and Firefox have done it traditionally.
So what was the reason for that, did they say?
Well, they give a really good use case in usability on UIs, and I agree with it. Basically, the tabs, the address bar is part of the page, basically. It's showing you what page you're on. So it doesn't make sense to have content that is for other pages below that. Like, if you think of it as a nested interface, the top-level thing should be the interface to each page. And they found that it is not only... It's easier to render and, I think, like, maintain all the object references and stuff, but... It makes sense. If you can find the video, it's worth a watch. It's probably about, I don't know, 15 minutes long.
Do you remember what site it was on?
I think it was linked by Ars Technica.
Okay.
I think the actual site, it was on the Mozilla site. Yes. Or maybe YouTube.
See, I think it's actually the opposite of the way, you know, you're describing that they said it. You know, I feel that the tab is what connects the page. because whenever I want to go from one tab to another, now it's right above the page. My mouse barely moves. Now my mouse has to go an extra 50 pixels to get above the address bar to the tab to change pages and then go back down another 50 pixels. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot.
Control tab, dude.
Well, yeah, but what if you want to go more than one? If you want to jump five at a time, you would use the mouse for that. You wouldn't sit there and control tab until you find something.
Yeah, I would. I'm lazy.
Yeah, I'm pretty keyboard heavy, especially on a laptop.
Yeah, on a laptop, I'll give you that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what do you think, Ed? Do you think this is a better design?
It's the one I use. I like it. I've played around with Safari. I played around with IE, Firefox. I like it. It's clean. It's simple. Not a lot of buttons. Everything's sort of where it needs to be for me.
It's fast, and it's not a memory hog. That's my two number ones.
That too.
Yeah, I do like that. But every browser is starting to do this now. They split, you know, tabs into their own processes.
Yeah.
So if one tab died, your browser didn't die, and that's what I hate so much right now with Firefox.
Well, I remember when I switched to Firefox version 3. When I would load it into memory in my XP machine, it would immediately grab about 150 meg of memory, like immediately.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, and then after you load about, you know, I don't know, 10, 15 websites, it's up to like 200, 250. And then when you'd hit the close button, it would jump up to like 350 or 400, and then it would finally terminate the process. And it would take it like 15, 20 seconds.
Oh, yeah. You could watch the memory go down and down and down. It wouldn't close right away.
Yeah, well, first it went up, and that's what I didn't get. But it's anyway, that's what when that started happening, that was about the time Chrome went public, and I was like, I'm sold.
Okay, so moving right along. We always talk about net neutrality, you know, at least one time or another. But just recently, we have some more people trying to block net neutrality again. And, of course, it's the right, you know, the grand old party, the good old Republicans. You know, I must say, you know, all things out in the open, I am registered Republican, but that is only so I can vote in all of the elections. You know, I would prefer not to be, but the party that I want to be doesn't get to vote all the time, so I'm stuck registered Republican for now. But obviously, this is one of those cases where I do not like the things that the Republicans are doing. I actually agree with the Democrats on net neutrality because they're all for it. But did any of you guys read this article on what the Republicans are doing? Or Ed, since you're new here, you know, what are your thoughts on net neutrality?
My thoughts on net neutrality, I'm not really for it. I don't see a need for it. I think that ultimately the market's going to decide what happens with the network. I think that having a standard network works fine. The internet seems to work. You know, the technology works together. I think that if bandwidth companies and internet service providers want to use their technology to better leverage what they have or to better maintain what they have, that's fine by me. If they want to hook up deals to deliver certain content faster than other content, that's fine. If they want to try to prevent piracy, let's say, you know, a lot of one of the issues I've seen relates to blocking P2P traffic a lot, which a lot of it is basically pirated content moving around movies, music, and so on. Being that a lot of these ISPs are parts of companies that own this content as well, they're not only the service provider, they're the content provider. Well, it makes sense for them to want to protect that investment. I don't see a problem with that. I don't think it's going to get to the point where a lot of the concern is that folks will start blocking other people's networks or start blocking other people's contents. I don't think you're going to see that. The consumer isn't going to let you get away with that for long.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't know. I mean, you guys already know my thoughts on this. I am all for it. I kind of disagree with you in the fact that I don't like the part where they could make some people's traffic faster. You know, like Al Franken just recently was talking about net neutrality. He said, you know, what's it going to be like whenever you go to hit Fox News and it comes up right away, but you try to go to some, you know, other side news site, some little news site run by somebody like me, and it takes, you know, 10 minutes to pop up.
I think that's Al Franken fear-mongering, basically. I don't think that will happen. I mean, you're always if you're subscribing for at least a certain amount of speed, that's what you should get. And I don't think there are going to be companies that are going to try to affect your connection in a negative way, even if it is something they are politically opposed to or if it's a competitor or something like that. I don't think you're going to see folks getting that cutthroat because, again, the customer is not going to let it happen. If Fox works a deal so that, you know, based on quality of service or whatever, their traffic gets through faster, or if they're running a separate pipe to certain areas, I don't see a problem with that, really.
So what about, let's take this one step further, something that a lot of people have been talking about, and probably one of the big reasons why a lot of people are for net neutrality is tiering of the internet. If the internet turns into what cable is like now, or what satellite is now, where you sign up for internet, and if you want to access sites like YouTube or Hulu, that's another $10 a month. If you want to access sites like, I don't know, CNN or Sports Illustrated, that's, you know, another $20 a month.
Yeah, but I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, even an article we have here coming up seems to point to that as well. But I don't want to get too far ahead of you at the moment.
Let's all roll this into one, though. So,
okay. Well, just one thing to interject. I mean, there's two competing like ideas that are built into TCP/IP, and I've mentioned this before, and this is one of the reasons that I don't believe that this is even necessary, and that, you know, the whole that. It's the idea of the end-to-end congestion control. TCP/IP has this built in. So there's really no reason to give priority to most asynchronous types of communication and non-streaming. So we're mostly talking like data transfers, things that don't have to happen in real time. Then there's also the idea that was introduced later, and that is quality of service, like Ed mentioned. And quality of service, or QoS, is a way of segmenting your connection at a router or even at the computer level to allow even within your whole network behind a router to allow certain protocols more preference. And this is really a protocol-to-protocol thing. Not it's agnostic to the provider. It's just what type of data it is, what ports it uses.
Right, it's handled at the router and switch level.
Yeah, and you know, basically, this would be so that they can provide better performance on video, which is a streaming, non-asynchronous or synchronous type of thing.
Non-asynchronous.
meaning that the user wants a real-time experience. Now, that can be like helped along by buffering and things like that. But there's these two competing things, and I think what's happening is, or what may happen, and what everyone's fearful of, because I think it has happened. Ed, I mean, you mentioned it, they don't think it'll happen, but I think that they will use the QoS protocol to, block certain types of traffic or throttle it. And it probably won't come down to the point where it's one person's view is throttled and another person's view is not throttled, meaning, you know, in the news media. But
and were that to happen, the end result, the consumers and the hackers would find a way around it anyways. You know, there's always ways to mass traffic. There's always ways to get around that, whether you start building your own networks out or something of that nature. But your message, your viewpoint will get through. Your data is always going to get there somehow.
Yeah, I partially agree with you on that the people will find a way around. But, you know, as I'm always the person bringing up this point on the show, it's always the people like us, the people who know how to. You know, our parents, our cousins, our family, you know, other people we know who don't have technical jobs, who aren't as technically savvy, they're not going to figure a way around. They're just going to pay an extra $40 a month if that's what they offer to be able to get these services, you know? So, I mean, yeah, people like us, we'll get around it no problem, but the rest of the world, not so much. But speaking about broadband data and the speed that you get, next thing that, you know, kind of keeps up with this whole net neutrality argument is that broadband has basically been redefined. It used to be that if you had a connection greater than 200 kilobits per second, which for those of you wondering, that's only like four times faster than dial-up, you used to have a broadband connection, 200 kilobits a second. Now, the FCC has said, no, with all this video out there, with all of this, you know, high traffic, high demand websites, broadband is now 4 megabits a second.
That means I am now bandwidth poor.
So am I.
I've only got about, 3 meg?
I have a 3 meg connection.
Yeah.
And so I do not have broadband anymore as far as the FCC is concerned. And on one hand, I think this is great because this means that somewhere along the line, the companies that provide me internet service are going to have to up it. And I'm going to have to get faster.
Or we're going to reclassify.
Yeah, or we're going to, you know, we now can get in line for some federal program, I'm sure.
Right. That's the other thing they were talking about. Yeah. So, is this necessary?
I mean, our standards in broadband, I think, are low. I mean, if you look across Europe and especially Asia, they're low.
Yeah, we're probably the lowest speeds from a not third world country.
Yeah, and also like price per like megabit is pretty low or pretty high. You know, we have to pay a lot for our service comparatively.
Oh, no kidding.
The you know, you mentioned though that I guess you guys probably have Verizon, and you said that that's
why. I have WiMAX. It's 3 meg up, 3 meg down.
Oh, okay. And I have Verizon, and it's 3 meg down, so technically it wouldn't be considered broadband anymore. It is 1 meg up though. And the interesting thing to note is most cable providers only provide like 512 up.
Yeah, that's the thing. You might be getting like the 12 megabit download with a burst to 20 megabit, but your upload speed is horrible.
Yeah, not sure what it is on Atlantic Broadband. I have ABB.
I think they're
3 meg down. I don't know what it is up. But.
I think their top end service is 5 down, 512 up. At least that's what. Yeah. At least the last time I checked. But anyway, this could declassify you both ways in your downstream connection and your upstream connection. And one thing people don't realize is there's a lot of back chatter when you're downloading at a high a large file. There's a lot of back chatter, and you can actually flood the upstream connection just
by your axe.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how noisy or how much data packets have to get resent and that sort of thing. But I like that there's standards. I mean, I think that they need to. It's something like the FTC would do in terms of like defining what are you selling. You can't sell something under false pretenses.
And especially on services like cable, where you share your connection with your whole town, so you might have that 512 kilobit uplink speed, but that's pretty much shared between everybody connected to your local center. You know, every place that your bandwidth comes out of. So. It's you probably notice that you're not getting the speeds that they say you're getting just because of that fact alone.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing to be careful about when classifying cable that way is that even DSL eventually has a pipe that it shares,
Everything eventually does.
Yeah, you're separate back to the head end or to the DSLAM in the telco station, but you still probably have like a single fiber connection coming out of that.
Right, the backbone, yeah. So moving along, I think this was what you were talking about, Ed, the next article with we were talking about tiering and people having to pay more. And this next article from Ars Technica asked the question, should broadband data hogs pay more? And as far as, what Comcast would have you think, the answer is yes. But as far as what this article says, they're like, no, that's the stupidest idea ever. So what were you going to say about this earlier?
No, it was just when I first read it, it was surprising. But after reading the data and reading the points they made, it makes sense. They've to a great extent, the ISPs have fairly fixed costs involved in providing the bandwidth and providing even the labor to support it. Those costs seem to be decreasing. Our bills are going up. The article also says, I think, says something to the point of. Lost my train of thought. Something to the effect of that a lot of them can handle the spikes from the power users or the bandwidth hogs fairly well.
Yeah, I think we're all flabbergasted every time we see that prices are going up, because really, what are they doing to our service that we have to pay more? They're not. We don't see them out there laying any more cable. We're not getting new fiber backbones. All the infrastructure is there for the most part, at least in normal metropolitan-ish areas.
It's the economy, dude.
It's the economy. Blame everything on the economy.
Well, I know. I mean, I'm not saying this is directly attributable, but it doesn't. Prices and goods and services are going to go up, and then because of inflation. And I mean, there's no real signs that inflation's all that bad right now, but it doesn't mean that your prices won't rise over time. But that said, everything else in the technology world gets cheaper over time, and internet service does not. And it's a bit of a dichotomy.
Yeah, and here's one of the stats from this article. International bandwidth has grown 66% each year for the last 5 years, but the cost of IP transit has dropped 22% a year at the same time. So even though we have all of these Hulu and YouTube sites, we're downloading movies and, you know, taking up exabytes and zettabytes and yottabytes, you know, across the network, the ISP's cost is going down 22% every year. What is going on?
Yeah.
This is just ridiculous.
Well, I mean, if you know anything about fiber, as long as the fiber is like a single mode fiber, that they can upgrade the boxes on either end of a piece of fiber that's laying underground for hundreds of miles, you know, and basically instantly upgrade the bandwidth of that thing without much work.
Or without much cost either.
Right. Well, I mean, you have to buy the new, like, devices on either end.
Right, the cards, but
the cards
whatever.
For whatever Cisco routers they have or whatever. But, you know, it's not in comparison to what they're doing. If they can triple their bandwidth, you know,
right? They're versus, not digging up a whole city to lay new cable,
right? Exactly.
Yeah, it's fairly cheap compared to the alternative.
Yeah, so I kind of agree. I mean, looking at the numbers in here, I mean, they basically they say it's about labor. Like that's what they're saying.
The only cost they gave was labor.
Labor costs are going up. It takes time and money to put these boxes in, and you know, give new cable modems to people and that sort of thing. But I mean, that said, I still don't understand why in a lot of cases they would even need new cable modems, because the old DOCSIS 2.0 modems they're good for 30 megabit, right?
I don't know. There was something I was reading. I forget where I read it, but the new DOCSIS 3 modems did something that the old ones couldn't do, so they had to upgrade people, you know, as they were going. I wish I knew what that was.
Probably like spy on you.
That's exactly it. They're already doing that. Especially if you have AT&T as your service provider. Okay, so the next article here from the New York Times, a fairly long article. If you read through it, it's a good one, though. The web means the end of forgetting. And Ed, I think you had some thoughts on this one.
Yeah, this one was kind of fascinating to me. I really like the issue of social networking and just in general, the philosophical issues of how do we live in a world where you don't forget or you can't forget, or where the worst thing you've ever done is the first thing people find out about you. When everybody's lives are online, whether they posted it or somebody else, you know, picked up their cell phone, you know, people at Walmart, that kind of thing. Interesting site, by the way.
Yeah, check that out.
But you know, I think a use case study or a study on elephants might help us, because as everyone knows, an elephant
they don't
never
forget.
Forgets.
Yeah, but what do they have to remember? So the problem is that we have more and more to remember. You know, especially, you know, with the prevalence of social networking sites, Facebook and so on, everybody's everything is online. I know I'm a poster child for Facebook, and I think you are too.
Everything that I've ever done ever is online.
Yeah, pretty much. But I've been kind of living in that since I was 15, back when, you know, there were, you know, bulletin boards that were single dial-up modems and so on, up through early internet BBSs and things
Gopher.
Like that. Do remember Gopher, yeah. ISCA BBS and University of Iowa, that kind of stuff. I've been doing this for a lot longer than most folks, and it's never really been much of a concern, because that sort of online life was for a long time fairly separate from, you know, real life. But those lines are kind of blurring, and with, you know, everybody's parents are on Facebook, and, you know, your companies are checking out what you're doing on Facebook and things like that. It gets a bit disconcerting, you know, with how much you can control, how much you can't control. How simple, stupid mistakes can really affect things, and on top of that, thinking about how much should it really affect it? You know, are companies going overboard? Are, you know, how much do we really owe to our workplace, to our social circles, society in general, with the things we do? You know, everybody parties, you know, sometimes. So what's wrong with some semi or more than semi drunken photos on Facebook type of thing? You know, yeah, but to me, what's the big deal? You know,
yeah. Just on that point alone, I mean, sorry to cut you off, Ryan.
That's right.
I mean, if you look at any companies, their CEOs and CFOs and CIOs, they all do the same thing too. They might not be posting it to Facebook, but if you've ever been to any sort of get together or party with higher ups from a company, they are just as bad, if not worse, than the normal employees.
Or something.
Yeah.
Right. So just the fact that we're on Facebook about it means nothing.
Here's the thing that I think that people miss. You know, I believe in a right to privacy. And I think that right exists online, even though it's a public sphere. But, you know, my house is in a town, right? And that town is public. You can walk around. But if I leave my door unlocked in my house, does somebody have a right to walk into my house and look at my pictures and then decide whether or not I can be employed or not at that company based on my pictures?
Not without you shooting them in the face.
Well,
yeah, pretty much.
Well, in Texas, yes, but not in Pennsylvania, unfortunately. But or fortunately, depending on the point of view. So I guess that's what I see as a violation of my privacy. You know, it takes a physical act of clicking on my Facebook page to see my pictures. In most instances, you know, so
yeah, but folks can also tag you in pictures and things like that. I've had some pictures show up that you from theater stuff and things that I've done that I probably myself would not have posted,
right?
I talk to the person, say, hey, take that down. You know, would you mind taking that down? And they're fine with that. It's the privacy issue is a little different in the case of a social network because yeah, you want it to be private, but it's still out there for everybody to see unless you're very, very careful with your right. security settings and things like that. And to the Google presentation that you had mentioned last week had talked about that, where basically most social networks at this point are still sticking you in one network rather than the five or six that you typically belong to. I think long-term as the social networks wise up to that, and make it easier to segment your information off. Maybe some of this goes away to yeah. where, you know, you can share what you want a little easier with just the people you want. I use Facebook security a lot. Not as much now as I used to. I finally decided I really don't care how much my networks intermingle, and it's sort of an experiment of my own here to see once everybody realizes. You know, there are different circles I run in and different groups of friends with different interests and things like that, and it's just kind of interesting to see them all kind of meshing together a little more than they used to. But I think over time, you know, you'll be able to control that a little better, and maybe some of this goes away.
Yeah. I mean, I think people need to be aware of the privacy or security, at least, on their site. But I still don't think anyone has a right to take anything off of your page. Number one, it's copyrighted. I mean, if you took the picture, it's your picture, you know.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. It does take the physical act. And somewhere along the line, people got the idea that just because it's on the internet means that it is totally 100% different than if it was in real life.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, sure, it doesn't tangibly exist. You can't hold a Facebook page in your hand, but that doesn't mean it's any less real than walking into your house and looking at something. You know, the same rules should apply. At least that's my feelings on it.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree. And I think, too, I think in terms of companies using the information, things like that, I think it's time for the average Joe to start really expecting a little more from their employers and things like that, to where the employer needs to recognize that there is a separation between work life and private life and stay out of it.
Yeah.
And as an employee, maybe you don't want to work for a company that is checking people's Facebook pages out.
I'd say if it's not criminal activity, then then no one has any business knowing. Because once it's criminal, it goes in the police blotter and it's in the paper.
Right. It's public domain.
Right. So, you know, criminal records are public domain. But if it's not criminal, nobody has a right to use it in any way, shape, or form, or really even know it. So that's just my opinion.
Yeah. As far as the security privileges or security options are concerned, you know, if you're my friend, you've probably noticed that everything of mine is public to everybody. As long as you have a Facebook account, you can read all of my stuff. And I don't know. A lot of people I know are like that. Some people I know are the exact opposite. They have it, you know, limited so you can't even search for them. You know, it's up to you. Whatever you feel is good. I mean, in the line of work that I'm in, you would think that I would have everything locked down a little bit, but it hasn't bitten me yet. And I post literally everything that I do everywhere at any time.
I'm pretty much the same way. And my views on a lot of things probably being a lot more skewed than yours are. Yeah,
that's true. Yours are a little out there sometimes.
A little bit, yeah.
So keep it in line with the internet. Let's get away from a company snooping on you. This one is actually quite a bit of a problem. Or maybe it is, maybe it isn't. We'll let Ryan talk about this one, another Ars Technica article, that the internet is running out of IP version 4 addresses?
Yeah. I mean, this has kind of long been coming. Everyone knows that the IPv4 is a 32-bit address space. So it's what, 4 billion addresses. It seems like a lot, but that's, you know, there's 6 billion people in the world, and if you gave everyone an address, there wouldn't be enough.
Yeah, and you think about it, people's devices, phones, PlayStations, Wiis, all of them have addresses now. Yep. So one person has 30 or 40 IP addresses assigned to them.
Well, not necessarily. You know, on your home network, all of those devices are probably, yeah, they have addresses, but they're in the private space behind your router, and, you know, NAT's taking care of a lot of the...
There has been a lot of, you know, NAT is one technology, and that's network address translation, that has sort of helped mitigate the problem into a large extent, because at one time, you know, there wasn't such a thing as a little Linksys router, you know, that did this NAT for you. You had to have an actual router, which could be a physical computer or some other piece of hardware that would, you know, break out your network and assign each device an IP address.
A public IP.
Yeah. And you would have to have received a block of IPs from your ISP. That's not really necessary anymore, but there's a lot of things that are coming about or coming of age here, like the smart grid. And they think a lot of devices, you know, that'll be manufactured will have a network address, an IP address, so that it can communicate back to the power company and turn off and on in peak demand and that sort of thing.
Fridges, toasters.
Right. air conditioners especially. But anyway, getting back to the article, so there were some original predictions that came out several years ago that said we'd have addresses run out probably in the 2040 to 2050 range. But some of those have been really tightened up, and they're saying that it could be as early as 2012. There's only, I think, what I read was 16 /8 networks left, and a /8 network is 16.8 million addresses. So there's what's that work out to? About 140 million addresses.
It's not a lot. You think the number is huge, but it's really not a lot.
Right. You know, the population growth alone could probably easily eat that up. You know, and it could be a problem. So the obvious fix is to switch over to IPv6, which is a 128-bit addressing system. And basically, it would give everyone enough addresses to have their own internet in the world. Everyone in the world could have their own internet set of addresses.
Literally, like, the entire internet.
Yeah, like, so every person could have 4 billion or more addresses. But that's going to take a lot of work on the part of operating system manufacturers, device manufacturers, routers. I mean, there's already an IPv6 network that exists, but getting that integrated in with everyone else, it's going to take time.
Yeah, the hard part is just the switchover, mm-hmm. you know, because it's not that easy to do.
Right.
Now they have, you know, pretty much software converting, tunneling software, converting IP version 4 to IP version 6 and back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the switch to all IP version 6 is going to take a lot of effort on the part of literally everybody.
Yeah. The one thing that I thought of, though, that, and I'm wondering why they can't just do something like this, is basically just do NAT at a really, really high level.
This is what I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah.
Crap, you got to it before me.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you think of it, one of the things they mentioned was smartphones and how they all have their own public IP address.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Why are smartphones not just like computers on our own network? Why are they not behind an AT&T NAT or a Verizon NAT? They don't need public addresses.
Well, I think technically when you get... I mean, they're selling broadband service. I think you're supposed to get a public IP when you get a broadband service.
Okay, you're supposed to, but your phone doesn't need that. Mm-hmm. You know, cell phones could be behind NATs, and we all know of companies that own Class A or Class B networks, and they really only have, like, 10 public-facing servers. They don't need, you know, a billion IP addresses. So there are a lot of companies hogging up the rest of the IP version 4 addresses that they could easily, you know, just own a Class C or lower and use NAT for everything.
Yeah, and that was a question that I had. When they're talking about how many addresses are left and how many are allocated, they're talking allocation but not necessarily use.
Right, so they're talking about owned. Right.
It's similar to the old phone exchange problem where if you wanted one number, they'd give you 1,000 or 10,000.
Yeah.
You know, which really sort of predicated the expansion of more area codes and a lot of until they sort of reformed how they allocated those addresses out.
Yeah.
Same type of thing here. What's the possibility for going back and sort of auditing that? And
well, they probably could, but
reclaiming some.
Right now, the point is that they're owned, so there's no way to allocate that. Like, they can't presume to reallocate that address until some work is done.
Yeah, this is where you would like to think that there could be a good faith meeting of people and say, hey, are you really using these? How about lowering your purchase and giving them up? But you know, nobody's going to do that,
right? Well, like I said, what I was saying about NAT though, at a higher level, I'm wondering why they just can't, you know, have the whole internet run on the backbones, that is, run on IPv6, and have the routers do the translation between these remote IPv4 networks.
I don't know how much processing power that would take.
I don't know.
I don't understand.
You need some really, really big tables.
Yeah, I think you would.
That would suck.
Your routing tables are going to look monstrous. Maybe tables are going to look horrid.
Maybe I answered my own question. Well, Ed answered my own question.
Okay. So now we're going to take a little break and have a word from our sponsor for the evening. Tired of working? Hate your job? Or just have a case of the Mondays? Well, head on over to Tchotchke's. Try out any of their out-of-this-world appetizers, such as the pizza shooters, the shrimp poppers, or extreme fajitas. Tchotchke's, where 15 pieces of flair is just the bare minimum.
I love that place.
Yeah, that is a great place. I am there every day.
It's delicious.
And the flair, that kind of gets to me, though. I don't know about the flair.
Yeah, it's kind of annoying.
Stupid flair. Okay, so moving right along, we got a couple of security articles to talk about now. The first one, I think, is a long time coming. I kind of wonder why they never did this in the first place. And that is, Adobe has added a sandbox to their PDF reader to basically ward off any hacker attacks. You know, if you've ever followed any of the security updates, basically just for Adobe Acrobat Reader, you've seen that there has been a lot of them, and some of them were pretty bad, that because of the type of things that you can embed in an Acrobat or in a PDF document, you could exploit that through the Adobe Reader and gain control of a system pretty much. But now Adobe has made it so whenever you open up a PDF, it goes into a sandbox. So even if somebody were to hack your open PDF via some malware that they put in there, it's not going to affect the rest of your system. You know, they might crash your running instance of Adobe Acrobat, crash the sandbox, but it's not going to harm your system. So I don't know what you guys think, but I think this is awesome, and I wonder why they didn't do it 20 years ago whenever PDF was embedded.
Well, I mean, I was just reading the article. They talk about this Microsoft's practical Windows sandboxing technique. My guess is the reason they didn't do it is they weren't able to before. I don't know exactly how this works. I would imagine it uses some part of the virtualization technology that's built into the new Intel and AMD CPUs and supported by the newer Microsoft OSs.
Yeah, that seems to be exactly, you're right, what they're doing according to the article. What gets me is that, you know, if you look at any Unix-style system, you know, they've had jails and chroot jails, you know, whatever you want to call them, whether you're Linux or BSD, for literally ever. You know, you could quote-unquote sandbox anything ever and not have it affect the rest of your system. So, I mean, I don't know this for sure, but has Windows just not had this ability ever? Like, could you just not sandbox stuff before the addition of, like, .NET languages and, you know, languages that are sandboxed in and of themselves?
I don't know. I don't know too much about sandboxing. You know, I know a little bit about the virtual machines and that sort of things, and I could assume that maybe they're using that, and that's a pretty new technology to Windows, at least in the mainstream aspect, like where it's, you know, it's they had virtual servers and all that sort of stuff before, but to where it's actually in the desktop OS. I think it's a good idea, but it's still only as good as the API. You know, if there's holes in the API, there's probably still a way through it.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a good idea, but like you said, it could be broken tomorrow if somebody's good enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, so keeping up with all of these security vulnerabilities, and you might know, you might not, but companies actually pay money to people who find security vulnerabilities. Some do it publicly, and some do it not so publicly. They don't advertise that they do this, but two companies have recently come out with some new numbers that they will offer you if you report real security flaws. The first one being Mozilla, you know, specifically their Firefox web browser, which, you know, I'm a fan of, but they will now be paying $3,000 for each eligible security bug that somebody submits to Mozilla. And they have some rules on that. You can't just, you know, find something stupid and give it to them. It must be original, previously unreported, must be a remote exploit, meaning it can't be something that you do from the machine that you're on. The bug has to be in the most recent supported version of Firefox. You can't pick something that's, you know, 10 versions ago and say, hey, give me $3,000. And it's not due to any third-party software. It has to be a bug in Firefox, not the, you know, any extension that you might have installed. So those all seem, you know, normal rules. I mean, you would expect those. But Mozilla, you know, these two articles here kind of go together, so I'll just lump them all into one. Mozilla's doing it for $3,000, and Chrome, Google, is actually doing the same thing now, except they were a little more geeky. They upped their payment to $3,133.70, which if you spell that into a word, spells elite in elite speak. So they're saying, if you're an elite hacker, we will give you $31.33.70. So what I wanted to hear what you guys think about this in terms of companies like Mozilla and Google publicly saying, we will pay anybody who gives us a real bug that we need to fix. What do you think, Ed?
More power to them. I mean, hey, if it makes the experience better, if it keeps my computer free of fun, nasty spyware, I'm all for it.
So you don't think this has any negative effect? Because, you know, like Microsoft, they will pay people, but they don't advertise, you know, that they're doing this. You pretty much have to go to them and they'll look it over and they'll do something, you know, via email. They're not going to go public and say, we just paid this guy $5,000. Yeah. Do you think it gives consumers the wrong idea that, oh, these companies are paying money for this? Microsoft doesn't do that.
Well, I don't think it's the wrong idea. I think Microsoft hit the head on the nail on the head with, it's going to be an outlet for ransom. I mean, the especially for Windows, you know, maybe not for these browsers. I mean, the browsers are you know, important, but let's face it, they still have pretty low market share compared to Microsoft's products. So a bug in a Microsoft product has, a lot more value to someone who would want to sell it, I think, based on the number of installed instances of the application. And if it's in the OS, it's even higher.
Yeah, that's horrible.
Yeah. I mean, if you figure if IE is, what is it, like 60% of the browser market?
Way too much.
Yeah, way too much. You know, that means that there's, you know, 140% times that in Windows installations. So I don't know if my math's right on that.
It's a lot.
A lot more than that, you know, because like no one uses IE on any other app, any other platform. So I don't know. I think this could be bad. This could turn out bad, especially for OS manufacturers. If they're held ransom for these bugs.
I kind of disagree. I don't think that you'll see much of a ransom situation. One, if it is a case of, you know, an actual case of extortion, call the feds. They'll deal with it pretty much in a hurry. Your honest criminal, for lack of a better term, probably isn't going to submit a bug for money, period. He's going to exploit it. So it's not going to solve the you know, the hardcore hacker or the hardcore criminal that wants to exploit these bugs and find them. They're still going to find them, and, you know, with any luck, other developers will find them first. So yeah. I think Mozilla and Chromium, I guess, is fairly open, too. I think having the process fairly open and fairly transparent, and even the code base, too, I believe, in both cases is open. Anybody can look at it, peer at it. You're going to have folks that are going to look at it for good, and folks are going to look at it for evil. I think anything you can do to incentivize the good probably helps.
Yeah, just to go off of what you just said there, do you guys think this will change, say, the hardcore hacker bad guy into maybe a little bit more of a gray hat / white hat, because now he can possibly get more money from Mozilla or Google than he can from, you know, maybe selling it, maybe not selling it on the black market, depending on how big his name is?
I look at it kind of the same as a gun buyback program. I don't think it really does much good in the long run.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's going to I think it may incentivize them somewhat. You know, maybe some of these guys in the middle, like, that are just sort of enthusiasts, not real hackers. But, like, they talk in the article, and it's something it's a market I hadn't even really thought a lot about. But I'm sure that that the black market is going to pay a lot for these bugs, especially if they're juicy ones, you know.
Yeah, I would love to have some way of finding out what the black market pays without actually entering the black market and going to jail for it.
Well, you know, they had an interesting thing on, I think it was Dateline, or maybe 60 Minutes, and they went into one of these places, and they were showing how easy it is to buy, like, credit card numbers, like, from people overseas. You can get it, and, like, actually, it's kind of funny, U.S. credit card numbers with, you know, like, zip code information and a CVV code and all that stuff. That information is actually a lot cheaper than credit cards that were based in the UK because the US has so many credit cards.
I actually got that information for free by doing a Google search because some hackers are stupid. You could just do a Google search for a specific set of characters, and it would take you. You guys have probably heard of like these sites where you can just go paste in some text and then give somebody a link to the text that you pasted. Just a quick way to share text with people. Well, some stupid hackers were using that to share all these credit card numbers they had stolen from places. So if you did the right Google search, you would come to one of these, you know, paste-it sites. And I was looking at a list of thousands of credit card numbers, full names, addresses, CVV codes.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. So I guess, I don't know, the black market is, I think, probably pretty big. And, you know, I don't know that calling the feds is going to work in every instance because a lot of these are overseas. The same report that I was watching on TV that they're saying how easy it is or how easy it is for them to attack our systems now from overseas that I don't think the feds can do anything about it.
Well, it's one thing to attack a system. It's another to knock on your door and say, hi, yeah, I know about this, and if you pay me enough money, I'll tell you what it is.
Well, but
that,
I mean,
that requires a lot of two-way communication, coordination, things like that. And
I think these guys are probably pretty smart. They're not going to communicate through like some like normal email or Gmail account.
Frequently asked questions at Microsoft.com.
I just don't think it would be. I don't think it's going to be that cloak and dagger. They just, you know, they're probably just going to be stupid. And
I don't know. Microsoft's been in this business for a long time. I mean, I kind of trust their gut feeling on this, but I don't know. It seems like it could turn into ransom.
My gut feeling is that I think this is a good idea. I don't know how. Maybe they don't get enough bug reports in that they're not going to go broke doing this. But you know, I think it's a good thing. You know, they're showing that they care. It's not just their internal people looking at code. Anybody can look at it. Anybody can submit bug reports, and they'll pay you for your time. So, personally, I think it's a good thing. So, move right along into some more cloak and dagger stuff, I guess you can say. Going to talk about some mobile phones. Now, a couple weeks ago, we had mentioned that GSM, the standard that most cell phones use to communicate, if you're on... In the United States, if you're on a T-Mobile or AT&T, your phone communicates via GSM. If you're on Verizon or Sprint, it communicates via CDMA. Now, GSM is the most worldwide of the standard. You can pretty much go anywhere, and most networks around the world run GSM. And I mentioned a couple weeks ago that that was cracked. The encryption that GSM uses was cracked. And that was all well and good. It was cracked. You know, if you really had the computing power and the time to sit there and do it, you could snoop on people's conversations. Well, that was a couple weeks ago. This week, as of July 22nd, we see that there is a new program release called Kraken. And, you know, it's Kraken, like, release the Kraken. But this makes it a heck of a lot easier for the noob to crack GSM calls and snoop on your conversations. So what do you guys think? Do you think, personally, here's my thought on this. I think this will push cell phone providers now to more quickly roll out LTE and some sort of communication that uses better encryption because this new program makes it kind of like Kismet on a Linux box where if you want to hack a wireless signal, you can just open up the program and click a button and it's done.
Well, I think it's not quite that easy. The article talks about how you still need a radio and an interface to the radio front end and all that other stuff. And I think that's still a there's still some work that needs to be done. And they only cracked one of the encryption methods. It's called the A5/1 encryption. There's an A5/3 that's still secure. Some GSM networks don't use any encryption anyways. And in addition, it's only the original like 1G GSM, I guess, or I don't know if it's 1G or 2G, but I think it's 1G.
Yeah.
Like first generation GSM devices. If your phone's in 3G service, you're still safe.
For now.
Yeah. But because they found this, you know, it may allow them to find even more holes as they peel back the layers on the protocol.
Yeah, I don't know much about GSM and how many different layers there are or how many different standards there are, but I personally think it's going to make a push to LTE. And maybe not
LTE.
Well,
it might, but LTE is based on the same thing.
Do we know if they use the same sort of encryption or the same standards? I know it's based on the same, but did they upgrade anything really as far as encryption goes? Do we know this?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either. I wish I knew more about cell phones in general.
The protocols are very different, I think, from what we're used to. But compared to like TCP/IP type stuff, or the in the lower levels, the data link layers. But I don't know. I don't see it being a huge problem.
I see it being a start to a huge problem. You're right. Right now, it's nothing.
Yeah. Moving to LTE, I mean, obviously, if they haven't cracked 3G yet, so that would tell you even if LTE was based on 3G, that it should have more advanced encryption and would take yet another set of developments to get to that level.
Yeah, you'd like to think that's... It would use better encryption. You know, we don't know. Maybe it doesn't. But either way, you know, just a little warning that I guess if you have an old phone or you're in an older area with not so good coverage, you might still be running that old version of GSM. You know, you're not aware of it, but you know, maybe somebody's snooping on your calls. So maybe you shouldn't be using the phone all that much. Let's go back to smoke signals. That's what I think we need. So just one little note here in regards to Apple. It's kind of weird. We don't have, you know, this is the only Apple story this week. I don't know what's going on. But basically, everybody who knows me knows that I really, really wanted the white iPhone 4. I just like the look of white phones. My iPhone 3GS was white, and I really wanted to get a white iPhone 4. They haven't released it. They still haven't released it. They're not going to for a while. And do you know what the reason is?
I heard it was manufacturing problems.
Yes. Do you know what the manufacturing problem is?
No.
They can't make them white enough. Steve Jobs does not think they are white enough. That is the problem. I'm sure there are probably other problems, but that's like the big one that made the most headlines, is that he doesn't think they are white enough. They're not going out the door unless they are white.
So just call it gray.
Maybe gray iPhone 4.
Maybe somebody will buy it, eh?
Yeah, I don't... I mean, maybe... It's probably something to do with that super awesome 30 times stronger glass they put on the front that has a little bit of tint to it.
Yeah, there's probably some discoloration that it presents, or just some kind of like reflectivity change, or it refracts the light in such a way that...
Ooh.
Refraction. Everyone knows what refraction is, right?
Yeah. Rainbows.
Yeah. You ever dip your hand in the water, you know, at the pool, and your fingers look a lot shorter? That's refraction.
And there's a rainbow on your fingers.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that's all about Apple. I don't want to talk anymore about that. So let's move on to Verizon. And
it figures Kevin doesn't want to talk about Apple's failures.
Hey, I could bring up... Oh, I do. In a couple more articles, I bring that up. But let's stay away from Apple for a second. Let's talk about Verizon and Microsoft. You all have probably seen the commercials for the Microsoft Kin. It was a little phone, looked like a hockey puck, and they were claiming that it was going to be like the phone that anybody on a social network would use. Well, Verizon just told Microsoft, take these Kins away. Microsoft isn't selling them anymore. Verizon's like, hey, we can't get rid of these. Take them back. Did any of you guys like the Kin in the first place?
I don't think I ever saw it.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think I ever saw the thing at all.
I've seen pictures and videos and some write-ups, but I've never touched one. I really think the Kin was just, you know, Microsoft just trying something. Like,
yeah, they have the money.
They have the money to do this kind of thing. They can do, you know, product research actually in the market. And whether or not they got anything useful out of it, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not saying that they didn't hope that it would succeed, but It seems like they just missed the mark on the target audience.
Yeah, one quote from Sasha Sagan from PC Mag. The Kins are misbegotten, crippled creatures compared to pretty much every smartphone on the market. And I mean, that was pretty much true if you looked at any of the specs of it. If you just looked at it, I mean, it was pretty much a 2-inch by 2-inch rounded square. You know, it was the crappiest looking phone ever. You really thought it was a hockey puck. I mean, somebody could have thrown it down and played hockey with it. You wouldn't have known the difference. But the screen was small. To call it a smartphone was out there.
Yeah, the price for what it could do, the pricing was wrong. You know, the data plans were like the same price as the normal smartphones, yeah. And you couldn't even put apps on it, could you?
I don't think you could. And this makes me wonder. You know, we talked a couple weeks ago that Steve Ballmer is now pretty much the head of the mobile division. Like, you know, the one guy left the company, and now Steve is like the guy over top of it.
Mm-hmm.
This makes me wonder: was this his choice? Like, is he really doing that well in their mobile division if they came out with a product like the Kin?
Well, given the news I heard today, I don't think he's doing well at all. There's a lot of rumor going around today that
he might be leaving.
He's out soon if things don't improve.
Yeah, I saw that headline. I didn't want to bring it up because, you know, people would say I'm just Microsoft bashing, but thanks for bringing that up, Ed.
No problem.
It's not me this time.
Well, no, I mean, Ballmer's a unique character, and I think he doesn't... I think in the tech world, unlike most other industries, you have to be really in tune with, like, the tech, like, culture. And he seemed a little... he's always seemed a little disconnected to me.
Yeah, he kind of seemed like the old fart running the show, for lack of a better term.
Because, you know, even Bill Gates, like, he's getting close to 60 now, or maybe even his 60. The guy is still a nerd, man. Like, he's
into it.
Yeah, he likes the stuff. You can tell he uses it, and he's, like, a really forward thinker. So,
He shouldn't have stepped down.
Well, I mean, I think for him it was just a personal thing.
Right,
He's just tired of it, and he has enough money.
Yeah, I'm speaking totally non-personally. As far as Microsoft is concerned, he should have stayed on the helm.
Oh, yeah. I think they lost, you know, a good...
they lost their visionary. They lost...
Yeah, too bad, too bad. Maybe this is one step to Microsoft going under.
That said, though, I don't know that we can blame Ballmer on the Kin...
Kin on the Ballmer.
I don't think we can blame Ballmer for this because this recent, you know, step down of the mobile head of the mobile division. I mean, it was recent, so he probably was in charge of the Kin up until recently.
Yeah, the Kin probably got started 2 years ago.
Yeah, so
I still blame Ballmer. So moving on to,
I blame Canada.
I hate Canada. It's like the loft apartment over a really great party.
You know, they're really close to Redmond. They probably did do something.
Ooh. Okay.
Conspiracy theories. Next week on the Songcast.
So keeping in tune with failed phones, Google has said it. The Nexus One, a failed experiment in online phone sales. Now,
Google didn't say that.
Whatever. Google didn't say it like that. They admitted it, but they didn't say it was a failed experiment. Yes, maybe I should be a little more specific here. Google might as well have said it because it's true. But personally, I don't agree with this article. The article's from the International Business Times, and you know, they basically said what I just said. The Nexus One was a failed experiment in online phone sales. And the article basically says that people do not want to buy phones that they can't touch. Anybody who buys a phone, they want to go to a store, they want to play with it, and they want to walk out of the store with the phone. I 100% disagree with that. Here's what I think the problem was. The Nexus One, it was a good phone. When Google announced it, they said, hey, it's going to be out, it's going to be on T-Mobile, it's going to be on AT&T, it's going to be on all these providers. You can get them online, you can get them in stores. And even to this day, to the time they started discontinuing them, you could only get it on T-Mobile, and you could only get it from their website.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was one of the big things. I mean, personally, all of my phones that I've bought in the past 10 years have been done through a website. I have not touched them in the store, and I have been perfectly fine with it.
Right.
So I totally disagree with this article. I do think the Nexus One was a failed phone, but not for these reasons. So what do you guys think? Do you think that everybody wants to go to a store, touch something, and walk out with it?
Not necessarily. I mean, I've bought my phones sight unseen. I've bought other electronics sight unseen. As long as, you know, the site's reputable, the specs are listed, I can ask a question if I need to, or I can go to friends who have seen them or have played around with them. I can usually get enough information to make a good, educated choice on something without actually having to touch it. Worst case, I can always send it back.
Exactly. You always got the 30 days.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a good return policy, it's fine. But I know myself, I don't like the hassle. Like, I like being able to go to the mall or wherever, you know, take a look at it. But that's not the reason I didn't buy the Nexus One. I think you're right on that point. The reason I didn't buy the Nexus One is because you had to pay full price for it, basically. And
before you go on any further, let's explain what that means for the people who don't know. When you buy a cell phone now, you're paying a subsidized price.
Right.
Verizon, if you buy a phone from Verizon, they're paying $500 of your phone and you're paying $50 of it.
Right.
Google was charging you the entire $500.
Right, which is what the devices cost, you know, well, not what they cost to manufacture.
That's what they charge.
That's what they charge. But, I mean, if you know anything about the electronics industry, there's quite a bit of markup because it's not really the parts that cost a lot. It's the engineering and the design and all this other stuff, right? You know, because you have to build assembly lines to build these phones.
Right.
It's not like you can just, like, tape them together and, you know, with crazy glue and stuff. They have to make machinery to manufacture the phones. And that's actually some of the more even challenging aspects of manufacturing these tiny, tiny devices. But what's bugs me, and they talk about, I've heard them talk about this on Buzz Out Loud, is that, you know, we have this contract-based cell service in the United States. We're used to it. We like getting our phones cheap, and we don't mind signing a contract for 2 years. The problem with the Nexus One is, even if you paid full price, and even if you didn't sign the contract, you know, because you paid full price, you bought the phone elsewhere, you don't have to sign a contract, you still pay the same price per month.
You still had to sign a contract just to use the service.
Well, you may not have had to. I don't know if you had to sign a contract.
Yeah, but there are companies that don't make you do that.
Right, but you still pay the same price.
Right.
And that's my problem. So if you look at, like, total cost of ownership with any of these phones, like, you know, I remember they did examples with the iPhone versus BlackBerry, blah, blah, blah. And the prices aren't all that different depending on your service plan. But if you have to pay an extra $300 to $400 to get the phone in the first place, that does raise the total cost of ownership because you're still paying the same price per month. And, you know, if you're in a contract and you got a subsidized phone, that's great because, you know, they've built in that price into the per month fee. It's covering your bandwidth, your minutes, and the phone.
Right. That's a good point that most people don't realize. That's part of the reason why our plans are so highly priced.
Yeah. I mean, like, the problem is you kind of have this, like, it's almost like a, I don't want to call it like racketeering, but it's
racketeering.
It's in a way like maybe collusion or something, or like you have these phone companies, the providers, and the device manufacturers that are like all in this like model where you can't be free. You can't just buy the device and pay a reasonable price for service.
It's a well-known fact that the cell phone industry is an oligopoly.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
It's not a monopoly where one company owns it. It's an oligopoly where all companies own it, and they all make the same changes about the same time so that it acts like a monopoly. Yeah, nobody gets any better deal from one company to another.
Yeah, I think if there were more, if there was the ability to buy these devices from more places and, you know, buy, like, you know, a package, a wireless package to support it, a phone like the Nexus One could sell like hotcakes.
Yeah, if I could buy a Nexus One for $529, and in turn, whatever company I went to for my service, I would pay $10 a month instead of $30, awesome.
Yeah.
You think you're going to see that change now with the rules out today about sort of legalizing jailbreaking and that kind of thing to make it easier to take your phone and take it off of the system they want you to use it on?
I don't know, because if you look at other countries, you know, like Europe, they're pretty much doing what we think we should be doing. You know, you do buy phones more expensive. You know, they're more expensive. You pretty much pay full price, mm-hmm. and your plans are cheaper.
And you don't need a contract.
Yeah, so other places are already doing this. What's wrong with us, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it just, we fell victim to it early on.
Right, now we just agree with it.
Yeah, and it doesn't, it's in our consciousness, it doesn't bother us. But, I mean, it bothers some people. It bothers the heck out of me.
Right.
You know? I think everyone should have, you know, you can always pay your early term fee, but I just think that I just would like to be able to drop service if the company's like, you know, irking me. You know, I've had it happen before where they, you know, they really pissed me off, and it's like I would have dropped them, but I'd have to pay that $175 fee.
Yeah, I'd just like to own a piece of technology that's truly mine. You know, more and more the computers aren't yours. You know,
yeah.
Your phone isn't yours. It's your music CDs, your DVDs aren't technically yours. You have all this physical stuff that you can't really lay claim to because of either intellectual property or just licensing agreements and contracts and those types of weird things. It would be nice to have a piece of technology that you can actually own and do whatever you want with.
Right. Yeah, I hope we catch up to Europe sometime soon, because it would be nice to not have to pay $85 a month for my cell phone bill. Ridiculous. So moving right along, this is something that I was concerned about whenever Android first came out, and pretty much just of any non-Apple, I guess, smartphone where you have an application store or some way of getting applications on the device that aren't approved by a central location. And this is actually just a forum post that somebody, you know, posted asking questions. Hey, do you guys agree with me? And a ton of people started responding. Apparently, it's a big deal to them, too. Is that a lot of Android phones now are coming with bloatware. Basically, they're coming with non-standard applications that really weren't in the default Android load, and there are certain things that you also cannot uninstall without jailbreaking, which, you know, we recommend not to do. But basically just a bunch of crap that you don't want, that if you don't use it, you should be able to uninstall, and you can't, and it takes up space, and you can't get that space back. So a lot of people, I don't have a number for you because it's just a forum posting. I didn't see any real study done on this. But a bunch of people are complaining that, you know, their Android phones are coming with, you know, bloatware, just kind of like other phones, you know, did. You know, Windows phones came with a bunch of bloatware. The Evo comes with a ton of Sprint-based programs. You know, all these phones are pretty much doing it nowadays. Is this a problem for either of you guys?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it speaks to what we just talked about. You've got a piece of equipment, a piece of technology that you can't do what you want with. I mean, it would be like buying a car and having it come with five passengers. You know, really, is that really what you want?
That's kind of funny.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, to use your example of a car, this sort of reminds me of, like, when you buy a car, you get, you know, there's a factory stereo installed, and you have to deal with it. Like, it probably sucks. If you're an audio enthusiast, you probably want to upgrade it, and you got to, like, do a lot of hardcore engineering to get fit one in there. You know, I mean, you can call Crutchfield and they'll help you.
Somebody does. I mean, you know, by now it's fairly easy to get a dash kit for it and a wiring harness, and away you go.
Well, I mean, but the manufacturers of these cars are making it a lot harder, especially with like the integrated Bluetooth stuff, and there's no open standards. Like, you know, I'm not super impressed with the stereo in my new Kia. It has that Bluetooth integration, and it's like, The options are limited, you know.
You probably only have, like, what, two or three other ones that you can choose from that keep all the features and everything works.
I don't think there's any right now because it's such a new car. But there's options in terms of, like, you know, you can add things onto the dash unit after the fact and do it that way. But, you know, I think some of the applications that you're probably going to have to live with. Like, if they put a, like, billing app on there for you, you're probably going to have to live with the billing app. But I think it's not too much to ask that they don't, you know, install, like, it's like, you know, HP stuff, like, anymore. You get an HP laptop. Maybe they're getting better about this, but...
No, they're not.
They're not. Oh, okay.
Like, as I hold up my HP laptop.
Yeah. Yeah, formerly Compaq, now HP. Yep. I had a Compaq laptop a while back, and, I've messed with different HPs, and maybe they're starting to get better, but from my experience... They put so much stuff on there, like HP TV Manager and Smart Media and blah, 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 blah. And it doesn't make the experience any better. It
actually makes it worse because chances are all of those applications are going to pop up in your system tray once a day telling you, register, buy this, do this, update this.
It's just like, and it's like everything. It's, and especially just the way advertising works in the United States right now, it's always about the upsell. They want it. Once they sell you something, they want to sell you something else. And it's like, don't subsidize your products with this type of advertising. Just tell me what it costs and I'll pay it if you just leave me the heck alone. And I think, yeah, I would like to see less. I get a new Verizon app, like, pop up on my, you know, BlackBerry probably once every 2 months.
That actually took me by surprise. A friend of mine that I work with, every now and then he'll, you know, shout over the cube wall, "Hey, I just got the ESPN NFL football app." Like,
yeah.
"What? You downloaded that?" He's like, "Nope, just showed up."
Right.
"What?"
Usually what happens with Verizon is they put a link on there, and then you click it, and then you can download the program. But so it's just a link. You can hit delete. It's pretty simple.
Doesn't matter.
But it is a little annoying, I have to say. And I wish they wouldn't do that. So if you're listening, Verizon, please stop that.
Or all companies, HP, Dell, any technology company that preloads software. We don't want it.
AT&T, you can do it all you want. You can piss off those iPhone users as much as you want.
Thanks, Ryan.
Don't care.
My iPhone 5 is going to come preloaded with 12 gigs of software now. Okay, so this is the article that I was talking about earlier whenever Ryan said I didn't want to talk about any of Apple's failures. I wanted to throw this one out there. This is actually a failure on the Motorola Droid X. And
so wait, you're basically proving my point?
Yes. And I found this kind of funny for this reason, because the failure that the Droid X, or the failures that the Droid X is having now, are the same failures that the iPhone has had. Have we heard anything about this? Before you guys saw this article, did you hear about it at all? Chances are, probably not. Maybe you just saw a link about it somewhere.
I saw screen failure stuff, but I thought it was more about there was a separate screen separation. Or was that the Incredible?
I think that might have been the Incredible.
Oh, okay.
But either way, you know, similar failures to the iPhone, and we heard nothing about it. So I thought that was kind of funny, but let's just talk about
maybe
what...
Maybe it just happened.
Yeah, maybe it just happened.
It's only been out... The device has only been out for 7 days.
We heard about the iPhone on day one. Day zero, actually.
Well, that's because it was a huge screw-up.
Okay, excuses.
And people like to tear down the big guy.
That's true, they do.
That happens, too.
Yeah, so with the Droid X, there was basically two failures that this article talks about from Digital Trends. The first one is a screen failure, where you have flickering and banding on the screen, and sometimes the screen just doesn't work. You can't use it. You know, the failure is so bad that the screen totally screws up and you cannot use the phone. Because the Droid X, unlike the regular Motorola Droid, does not have the slide-out keyboard, so your screen is the only way of interfacing with it. So when this failure happened, you were SOL. The second failure was actually with the Moto Blur software, which is, we always talk about HTC Sense and their skin on top of Android to make their phones look good. Moto Blur is kind of Motorola's sort of software that lays on top of Android. And this problem was pretty much to do with privacy, that when you thought you were deleting text messages and call logs, you weren't. Because the Moto Blur software still kept them all. They still showed up in your history and in searches. So you thought you were getting rid of stuff. You know, this really isn't that big of a privacy problem unless you have people who steal your phone and look through your stuff. But either way, I just wanted to bring it up because it was funny to see that an Android phone had the same problems as the iPhone and nobody cared. What do you guys think about this?
Anybody use this phone?
That's a good question. I don't know anybody personally.
Well, they've been having trouble keeping it in stock, so I think they ran out the first day it launched, so I know that there's some people that bought it at least.
That's kind of funny because if you remember a couple weeks ago, Verizon was telling Incredible buyers, because the Incredible was on back order, just buy the X.
Yeah, they're like, "Oh, we won't have any problems with the X, we promise."
And day one, problems with the X.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't think this is any kind of like media cover-up.
I don't think it's a cover-up. I just think it's funny that nobody really cared.
Well, on the other hand, I mean, it is one of those things. I'll bet that the iPhone sold a lot more units on its first few days. Plus, it has a way bigger user base. So,
and a much higher expectation of quality and
yeah.
And
we talked about
as well.
That. You know, they sell perfection. That's what they do.
Yep, that is definitely the thing. You know, you make products that people think are perfect. And then when you come out with something and you slip up a little bit.
Yeah, Motorola's just shrugging their shoulders. We make crap all the time. What are you talking about?
And that's
we made iDEN. We made this crazy thing that only Nextel used.
How's the song go? If you don't expect too much from me, you won't be let down.
Like that. I don't know that song, but that should
be Jealousy. I think
that should be Motorola's theme song.
The problem with the Motoblur thing, they got to fix that.
Yeah, they really do.
Yeah, I mean, if they're going to put these layers on, this is kind of another like bloatware thing. If they're going to put these layers on, it's got to integrate into the phone's features correctly, you know.
And this is one of my major gripes with Android in general, is that you can do things like this.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
I bet somebody just forgot to turn on cascade deletes.
Stupid SQL statements.
Dang it.
Okay, so moving away from Android, and now we're going to talk a little bit about HP. We made fun of them a little earlier, but now HP says that since they bought Palm, they will be not making Windows 7 phones anymore. They're making WebOS phones. Ryan, I think you...
Yeah, this is a big hit. I think Microsoft is taking it on the chin for this one. You know, HP is one of their largest, if not their largest customer in terms of OEMs. They probably compete pretty well with Dell, but for them to turn around and turn their back on a long relationship with Windows Mobile... mainly in the pocket PC market. I don't know that HP ever actually made a phone. Did they make a phone?
I remember. Well, they made a. They weren't phones though. They were those stupid little pocket PCs.
Yeah, the pocket. Yeah, they've done pocket PC stuff.
Yeah, but they weren't phones.
So, but and I think they make a. Do you think they make a lot of other devices that you know used Windows CE? But, I think it's a hit because they're going to enter into the phone market for the first time. Maybe not the first time, but at least we're not sure about that, you know. But in a big way, they bought Palm. But then again, it's like, well, what did you expect? They bought Palm, and Palm has this different OS that is supposedly pretty decent. I've never really done too much with it. I think I messed with one for about 10 minutes.
That's a question I wanted to bring up. Have either of you guys – what do you guys think the problem was that the Palm Pre failed? Do you think it was...
They released it on Sprint. I mean, I'm serious about that. That was the biggest mistake they made.
So you think... See, I was thinking maybe it was more that the Palm Pre hardware was horrible and that made WebOS not perform?
I don't know. I remember when before the Palm Pre came out, Joshua...
Topolsky.
He was on Jimmy Fallon, like one of the first shows of Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. And he really liked it. He thought it was a great piece of hardware, and you know he had a pre-release version of it. And I think the device has a lot of the things that I want, like or that I wanted in a device. It has a nice tactile QWERTY keyboard. It has a really nice display. It's a slider. There's a lot of features. I don't know. What do you think, Ed?
I've never seen one.
You never seen one?
Again, I as far as mobile phones go, I live in a cave.
Yeah, I
really think it was Sprint though. I mean, I do, and I know I will venture a guess that the reason they launched on Sprint is because Palm was hurting badly, and they had to take the best deal they could take. And I don't know how all these deals work with the carrier, but I'm sure that you know they probably approached Verizon and they probably approached AT&T, and I mean AT&T probably had no interest with the iPhone, and I think Verizon probably scrutinized the OS quite a bit. And figured, look, we're going to have to develop all new tools for this thing to manage it. It's a brand new OS. You know, any of our software, I don't know, if it probably has a Java engine, so a lot of the Verizon stuff would probably work on it.
Well, all of the stuff was HTML and JavaScript.
Yeah.
Like, that was the OS.
Right. Maybe they wouldn't have had quite as hard a time as I first imagined in integrating with Verizon stuff. But Verizon's pretty controlling on their phones, and maybe they couldn't reach some agreement. But I think... For Palm to have been a success, they should have launched on a major carrier and took whatever crappy deal they got just to get the phone popular. And then once it proved itself, release even better hardware. You know, they should have just like held back a little bit, released the Pixie first or something.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Or maybe they shouldn't have released the Pixie at all. Maybe they should have, you know, done what Apple did and just sit back for a couple of years, put all your resources into one phone, and make sure when you release something, it's going to be amazing.
Well, I mean, that's typically what Apple does, though. I think that's like their playbook. You know, they do one thing in the market.
It is, but as far as cell phones are concerned, don't you think that's what people need to do now? I mean, you have the iPhone, you have the Incredible, Like, you already have these major players out there that are going to be really tough to beat. If you don't come out with something amazing, you might as well not come out with anything at all.
I don't know that you need to come out with something amazing, but you should come out with something solid at least. And sadly, I don't think enough companies, no matter what they are, do that these days.
I think it was solid. I think that was a solid phone. I think the Palm Pre was a solid phone. I just think most people weren't willing to make the jump to Sprint. Sprint really pissed off a lot of people when they took in. I know several people that were Nextel customers that dumped them because they said they weren't going to support iDEN or well not iDEN but the push to talk, and that really irked a lot of people. Their billing was kind of a pain.
Yeah, supposedly they had the best prices, you know, $100 a month, unlimited everything.
They didn't then, though. When they were bleeding customers, they were priced the same in about the same ballpark.
Right.
So what's really going to be interesting, I mean, we sort of got drifted off topic. I mean, yeah, this is a big loss, I think, for Windows 7 in some ways because it's their biggest customer of their other products. In another way, they never really had the customer to begin with because HP didn't make phones. Now, what will be interesting, though, is can a company like HP, with all its weight behind this WebOS, produce some decent phones that will compete in the market?
Right. I'm wondering if they have the software engineering capabilities, just because most of their business is enterprise, like huge servers. And then the small portion of their business is, you know, desktops and laptops for consumers.
Right.
And now they need people who understand how to write applications for phones.
I'm sure they retained part of the Palm. I mean, they bought Palm lock, stock, and barrel, right? And it wasn't just like, oh, we're buying your technology.
I don't know.
Oh, I thought they bought them locks. Other than they kept the whole.
I really couldn't tell you.
Like
I don't know.
I think it's a new business unit underneath.
If they did keep the people, maybe that's good. Maybe it's bad. Yeah. Maybe some of their people were the reason why it didn't do well in the first place. Yeah, so we'll see. We'll see whenever HP releases their next phone. But as far as Windows 7 goes, they might have lost HP, but Microsoft is giving a Windows Phone 7... They name their stuff so... Oh, come on, Microsoft. A Windows Phone 7 device to all of their employees as a way to get the device out there, get people using it, get people talking about it. My thoughts on this, I think this is an act of desperation on Microsoft's part, because in order for a company to give this away, to go public that they're giving it away like this, or they really go public. I mean, employees tweeted out that they were doing this, but now Microsoft has, you know, accepted it, said that they're doing it.
So Apple doesn't do this?
Oh, I'm sure they do.
Right. I mean, I think this is, if you want your developers to develop for the phone, you've got to give them the device so that when they develop the app, they get to use it.
Well, is this just a development app? Or I thought this was more of a personal, here, take it, yours. Like, I didn't think it was a use this for dev purposes only, bring it back to us.
No, I understand that. But if you want the culture to accept the technology, at least in your own company, and benefit from the apps they write, like if you want them to come up with good ideas, they have to have it and try and say, oh, I mean, like every phone has a built-in set of functionality, right? You know, even the iPhone has some functionality that you have to buy or add on, right? So they take it home and like, okay, what doesn't this phone do? And then they're like, oh, I really want a remote control for my whatever. So they write the app, you know, then basically
maybe it gets included.
Maybe it gets included. Maybe it gets put on the App Store to fill up the, you know. So there's this like it develops the ecosystem. Because that's what's so one thing that's been so pervasive about Apple is they have that ecosystem, and I think that you know this may help.
Yeah, I wonder if my basic thought was I wonder if they're doing this as a way to get it out there because they think it might not get out there otherwise. You know, I think they're a little.
I bet it's standard practice. You know, for something like this, they probably have done it on every release. They've probably given, well, maybe not every release and maybe not everyone in the company, but probably definitely certain business units.
Yeah, I would like to see numbers on this to see, you know, if Apple does this when their new iPhone comes out, if Google does this when their new Google phone comes out, you know, what all companies do this, and we're probably never going to know the reasons that they're doing it. But just to see who's all doing it is, I mean, you might be right. Maybe I'm completely off base here, but to me, it just seems like that they're giving it out because they don't think that the normal user base is going to get it because of phones like the iPhone and the Incredible and the X. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that they think that she thinks that he thinks that they think that the phone might not be good enough to make people switch.
Maybe.
So maybe this is the only way, but we'll see. You know, the phones
I wonder what device they're actually getting. If it's like a third party device or if it's the one like they've been kind of showing off in pictures.
Right, yeah. The article doesn't say. They just say they're getting a Windows Phone 7 device. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and even if they're doing that, depending on what carrier, I mean, you all know if you get a Verizon phone, you're probably not going to have Bluetooth enabled because Verizon kills it. You know, so depending on what phone they get with what, on older, not smartphones, but like feature phones, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so carriers kill features they don't like. So depending on what they get, yeah. I don't know. I wonder what device it is. I hope it's a good one. You know, I hope they give them something, and I hope this, like we were talking about with RIM, they need to come out with something amazing. I hope this is, you know, Microsoft's attempt at coming out with something amazing to compete with all of the other phones out there.
Yeah, the article says that the device is going to vary by market, so that's...
Yeah.
I guess it's whatever they had laying around.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea. I think that's a bad move on them to give... I mean, maybe it's a good idea to have people using different devices so they get a good feel.
Yeah, you get a better test of the device too, you know, or like of the OS and its components on different platforms.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it could go either way.
It does say they're not surplus kins though. So.
Oh, well, that's good. That's one up. So last article of the day is we've pretty much been talking about it the whole time. Windows Phone 7, you know, the technical preview is out. Did you guys see anything new that we haven't talked about in previous weeks, or anything that you wanted to bring up as far as Windows 7 Phone or Windows Phone 7 is concerned?
Did we mention that it doesn't have copy and paste out of the box, except for that was a pretty big oversight. And the other thing, what was the other big thing that's lacking? There was one other huge feature. I can't remember. It was something multitasking, except for the built-in apps.
Oh, right, right.
You know, so I mean, that's pretty much, that was the big takeaways from all the, you know, technical previews that I read. I've been following it for a while. I didn't really see a lot of surprises in the technical preview. I'm anxious for it to come out. I think they should focus on, you know, they should do it right, but they don't want to be too far behind. I think they really need to focus on getting this out before Christmas, you know, to make an impact on the market.
Right. I mean, as far as Apple's concerned, they're going to try to get the white iPhone out before Christmas. That's going to create a huge buzz.
Yeah.
You know, the Droid X and the Droid Incredible are going to come back in stock, hopefully, before Christmas. So they need to get their phone out there.
I mean, I'm definitely going to take a look at these things when they're available in the stores, because I think the UI is, like I said before, it's very forward-looking compared to other UIs.
See, I was thinking about that, and I haven't used it. I've seen some videos on how it works. But to me, after looking at the videos more, it looks like a regular operating system. Like, I mean, you look at the iPhone or any other thing, you know, there are icons on the screen, you press them, a program opens. The Windows Phone 7 devices, it's the same thing. I mean, they're tiles, so they don't look like icons, but when you touch them, the screen slides away and an application opens. So it's still the same paradigm.
In a way it is, but the thing you have to remember is that it's the kind of the natural grouping of the elements. Like, they have these like panoramas, they call them, I think, and that's where the tiles are like sort of situated on. And
that's kind of like the, what are they called, arrow look or whatever, the alt tab in Vista and 7. Is that kind of how?
Not so much that, but like the you know, when you launch into the, like, say you launch into like your contacts or your people like app, then you have all these like associated things arranged on this. It's basically a, you know, for lack of a better word, like a bitmap of the things that you can access, and you slide back and forth. So you have a view. It's like think of like having this picture outside of a window, and you're sliding around on that window to find things in that picture that you want to click on.
So launching quote unquote people doesn't just open up your contacts. It opens up a bunch of things that you could possibly choose.
Yeah,
from.
That you would slide back and forth, and they have this thing. I can't remember the name of it. They had a specific name. I should have reread the article, but that you can navigate like down and like left and right, sort of. I can't remember. It's sort of like a multi-layered type interface.
Yeah, I did see that. That seemed kind of interesting. I'd like to see how that works.
So, like, you know, to sort of to contrast and compare, the only real like grouping that you have in the iPhone, it's something they've just added, is that these like folders basically, and you can throw a bunch of icons into a folder, but everything's still very like just wherever it is, you know. You can probably, I think you can organize your icons and stuff,
but
it's just like they're just random groupings. Even in the same as with Droid, you know, you go to your applications page on a Droid, and it's like, or an Android, and it's just a big list of icons.
Yeah, there's no inherent meaning.
Right, there's no grouping. It's hard to find things. Like, even myself, I find myself searching for stuff. I just can't find it. Like, I want to go into the settings, and like, I go, once I'm in there, I'm like, what is it I'm looking for? Like, it's not necessarily intuitive to find the things. And this is true of the iPhones and the iPads settings page too. They're very cumbersome.
I generally lose track of what I'm trying to find when I'm in there.
Yeah, it's really cumbersome. So now I'm not saying that the settings are better on iPhone or Windows Phone 7, but I just think the overall UI and this idea of like grouping these tasks, and I just think it might present a more accessible interface to more people. And that may what makes it successful, because as big as smartphones are, as big as the iPhone is, it's still paltry in comparison to this, like, sales overall. I think, you know, people now, I think that's partly price, you know, problems, but
right. Yeah, when you can get other phones for $50 or free.
Yeah, but I know people that just wouldn't buy them because they don't want the complexity. Where, you know, maybe this new interface might abstract that.
And do we know whether Windows Phone 7 is coming out on not smartphones? Like, will it be on, I guess, not feature phones, not crap phones, but the middle class texting devices or what they call it?
I don't know. I think it's pretty much just going to be smartphones because they have those minimum specs.
Right.
So I think maybe we'll see something in the future. I don't know, like something kind of between Kin and Windows Phone 7.
Yeah, because that would be really interesting to see their sales numbers if they got their OS on non-smartphones.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, we just have to wait and see. There have been so many articles, people talking about them, videos, and none of us have really seen it, you know, in person or used it. I don't even know of anybody on any of the shows that I watch or listen to who have used one of these. So I guess we just got to wait. So that is it for this week's Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. You can find Ryan on Facebook and Twitter, username Ryan Lancey. And Ed, if people want to contact you, what do they do?
Oh, that's a good question.
Do you want people to contact you?
Sure, why not? I think I'm Ed Zaharak on Facebook. I don't know. You know, I don't know my Facebook username. I just kind of take it for granted.
So just search for Ed Zaharak, and I'm sure you'll find
him. If you can spell it, yeah.
Well, it'll be in the show notes, so will be able to see that. So if you want to submit an article for next week's Slongcast, next week will be episode 12, so tag it on Delicious, Slongcast 012, and we will do our best to put that in next week's show. So, as always, have a wonderful Monday night.